So activists have now come to learn the ways the state is manipulating the protests and how infiltrators have already been sent into the different protests across the country. And we have learned from that, and we're trying to prevent them to do the same as they did in 2011.
Well, I want to thank you very much. Miriam Arakh, anthropologist, democracy activist, currently based in Britain. Lecturer at the University of Westminster in London, currently writing a book about the February 20th movement in Morocco, where we are headed the week after Election Day. We'll be there for the week covering the UN Climate Summit. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkner, Marian Shea, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdien, Dean DeCastro, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Parlin.
The time is now 4:59. Up next is your Tuesday evening news.
Concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee will be meeting November 8th at 5 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, a series at Northwest Film Center through November 1st. Tackling wide-ranging, thought-provoking issues, activist filmmakers deepen our awareness of injustice and the values of dignity and equality as they tell universal stories of struggle and triumph. Films to be shown include The Crossing, an account of Syrian refugees on October 28th, and The Road, about the Chinese government building a superhighway through Hunan province. That screens on November 1st. Again, it's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, playing at Northwest Film Center in Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a local business owner drives supplies out to Standing Rock.
And the Gresham 7 talks about their arrest at a Gresham City Council meeting.
And live in Studio 2, we speak with Peter Zuckerman about vocational education funding and Jesse Beeson of Color Pack about open and accountable elections. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 1st, 2016. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. Do you have a coat you no longer wear? Or maybe your kid grew out of their coat from last season? The organization One Warm Coat is seeking donations of new or gently used coats, which they will deliver to foster children and adults in need. If you don't have an extra coat, you can also donate money. The national nonprofit is able to transform every dollar into two coats, and they've helped distribute more than 1 million coats at no charge to people in need since 1992. Visit onewarmcoat.org for a full list of drop-off spots.
On Friday, Portland City officials and a private developer announced plans to open a new 100-bed homeless shelter in downtown Portland. The temporary homeless shelter would be located at 333 Southwest Park Avenue in downtown Portland. The building is owned by Tom Cody, a local developer, as was an outspoken opponent of using the Terminal 1 waterfront property as a homeless shelter. The homeless shelter will be financed by the City of Portland, the City of Gresham, Multnomah County, and the Home Forward Housing Authority. The Nonprofit Transitions Project organization will manage the shelter. The Transitions Project runs several shelters around the city, providing more than 500 beds per night in the city. The new shelter hopes to open by Thanksgiving. Chris Cassetto, Dax Cassetto, Anna Linden, Melanie Rosenthal, Christopher Hutchins, Jeff Singer, and Pastor Steve Kimes, better known as the Gresham Seven, were arrested earlier this year after shutting down the Gresham City Council meeting. The group was agitating for affordable housing and services for the houseless in their town. A lot has happened since their protest. KBOO's Lisa Loving caught up with the pastor, Steve Kimes, about what happened, why, and what's next.
This was actually the first action of people being swept off of the Springwater Trail. We wanted to make that conversation public, but it was being done in back rooms. We were protesting in order to delay a vote so that way the conversation of sweeping people off of the Springwater, as it turned out, hundreds of people off the Springwater, so that way it could be a public conversation and we could talk about it. Anyway, so we were arrested at the demonstration, and the beginning of next week we will go on trial for that.
I understand that there were no houseless shelters at the time in Gresham, or very, very few. Can you just set us straight on that one aspect?
Right. At the time, there were no shelters, and Gresham actually had their literature and everything to say there are no shelters in Gresham. Everyone knew that, but they decided to go ahead and close down 60 acres of property that homeless people were living on at the time.
Pastor Steve, what has changed since that day?
Well, a lot has changed in Gresham over, that's getting close to eight months ago, I think. A lot has changed in Gresham. They have had a task force work over the last year to be able to present ideas to the city council of what to do. They allowed Human Solutions to open up a women's shelter in Gresham city limits, and they also have hired a person from Utah to directly interact with the homeless. But they have also swept every homeless person who was staying overnight on the streets or in there. They swept them all out of Gresham and pushed them into Portland. So Gresham has done a lot for and about the homeless since we've been arrested. Some of it is very good, like the shelter, and some of it is very bad, like the sweeps.
All right. And now, Pastor Steve Kimes, you are one of what is called the Gresham Seven. What is your plan as a group for the future?
Well, right now we're hoping to to get through the trial. And we want to see that the homeless are being heard by Gresham. We would love to have more shelters, to see that there's more shelters. For us, we're looking to see if there are other opportunities for us to be involved to make Gresham a better town for everyone. And if we can do that through helping people, then we'll do that through helping people. If there's a possibility of helping people through protests, then we'll do that as well.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
The Portland City Council is currently reviewing an election reform proposal called Open and Accountable Elections, aimed at limiting special interest campaign contributions in elections and allowing for more representative and accountable government. This is not the first time that Portland has taken the lead on limiting money in politics. In 2015, the city implemented a public financing system called voter-owned elections for a five-year trial period. After some bumps along the way, that experimental program was not renewed by voters at the end of the trial in 2010. But now, 6 years later, the City Council is considering other options to achieve the same ends. Here to talk about this is Jesse Beeson with Color Pack. Thanks for coming in tonight, Jesse.
Thank you for having me.
So get us started off by telling us what Color Pack is.
Sure. Well, specifically, we are a political action committee supporting candidates of color who we think are disruptive, effective, and authentic. But broadly, we're building an organization that ongoing will be doing recruitment, training, electing, and supporting folks of color to run and win at all levels of office here in Oregon.
And when you say disruptive, what do you mean by that? Can you give an example?
Sure. I think for a lot of folks in Oregon, we often aren't we aren't cognizant of the fact of just how diverse Oregon is. And so when we're thinking about policies, we are often leaving folks out. And so we want to see candidates who are unafraid to speak up for those who aren't represented.
So what obstacles do you see to getting more people of color to hold office in Oregon?
Well, I think there are a few barriers. First and foremost, it is the subtle but very powerful power structure about who is and who is not asked to run, about who is and who is not promoted to win, and about who is and who is not supported when they do win. We hope to address a lot of that as Color Pack, but the third barrier is more than any one organization can tackle, and that's money. We think that our elected officials should come from all communities, not just those with access and wealth. But here in Portland and across Oregon, we know that candidates spend too much time raising money from wealthy donors and special interests instead of engaging our communities on the issues that matter to them.
Hmm. And it seems like it's really difficult to get at institutional biases that are kind of a symptom of structural systemic racism. How do you go about fighting that?
Well, certainly as an organization, Color Pack, we're going to do a lot of things to help address and fight that. But in terms of money, we know that helping offer a different path for folks to win without playing the usual money game is a big win. And that's really what we are facing here in Portland, the opportunity to implement that.
And talk about the role of open and accountable elections in reaching the goal. And the goal being of greater people of color in office.
Sure. Well, so in Portland, in 165 years, we've had just two people of color in Portland City Council and only seven women. So we know that we can do better. And we know that, frankly, that's not who Portland is. So open and accountable elections would offer up another path besides just the hamster wheel of dialing for dollars among the same few hundred wealthy donors that finance the bulk of campaigns here in the city.
And is open and accountable elections a policy or a group or an initiative? How do you classify it?
Good question. It's a set of reforms that the Portland City Council is considering. So it's a set of new laws to remove some of the barriers that we've been talking about to running. And the centerpiece of that reform is a powerful and proven small donor public matching program that multiplies small donations from voters.
And who authored the open and accountable elections proposal?
Well, it's being spearheaded by Commissioner Amanda Fritz, but there's a broad coalition of which we're a part of that's been a part of helping shape and craft the reform. We've been working with not only local organizations, but national experts who really know how to craft a program that works.
Can you give us a recap or an overview of Portland's history with publicly funded elections?
Sure. This is not the first time we've tried to do something like this, and you mentioned it briefly in your intro. So in 2005, the Portland City Council passed what they called back then voter-owned elections. And we saw at least two cycles of elections happen under that system. And it was agreed to at the time in 2005 that 5 years later they would put it on the ballot. And so in 2010, it appeared on the May ballot. Despite funded opposition, lost just narrowly by around 1,000 votes. So we know it's something that Portlanders support. But frankly, in the middle of a recession and just a few months after the Supreme Court ruling in Citizens United, people just didn't feel like it was the thing they could get out and strongly support. But since in the past 6 years, as we've seen how much money has played a role, giant money in our elections, people are really hungry for other solutions. And we think this is a great one.
So we generally think of candidates themselves when we think of electoral reform, but this effort aims at changing how everyday people relate to the elections by either making smaller contributions or even deciding to run. Can you talk about how that works?
Yeah. So from the donor side, what's exciting about this program is that it treats even small donors like they're big donors, right? Because it matches their donation. So the first $50 that you give to a candidate is matched 6-to-1, which means if I can give $50, that turns into $350 for the candidate. So it means that a senior on a fixed income can see her $10 donation become $70, or the restaurant worker can see her $25 become $175 of impact. So it's really huge. It changes who candidates see as someone they have to spend time with and try to get a donation with, because now everyone can potentially be a big donor. So that's pretty exciting. Yeah. And then on the candidate side, it now means that candidates don't have to have a Rolodex of rich people to make it happen, that they can really go to their community and ask them for their support.
So looking at things as they exist now, can you talk about the financial details? How much money funnels through? Do you happen to know like any figures off the top of
your head? Yeah. So a typical city council race could cost up to $250,000 in the primary and another $300,000 into the general. And when it comes to the mayoral race, we're talking way in excess of $1 million. In this last mayoral race, we know that Ted Wheeler raised and spent at least $800,000 and didn't even face a general election. So we know it's expensive.
And which organizations and communities are pushing for this policy? Are there any that have large reputations in town that are worth mentioning?
I think we like to think so. We're a broad coalition, and we've named ourselves now A Voice for All Portland. And you can see a list of all of us at avoiceforallportland.org. But it has a lot of folks who you would expect and a lot of folks who you wouldn't. So we have great groups like Common Cause and Osberg, who have been at this kind of work for a long time. But we also have great environmental and racial justice organizations like the Coalition of Communities of Color, the Asian Pacific Network of Oregon, the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, just a lot of new voices at the table saying that this matters to them as well.
So this is already well underway, and you've already talked about the mission, but what is the vision, I guess, that this hopes to accomplish?
I think the vision is a more reflective city council, right? We know that one out of three Portlanders is not white. We know that over half of our kids in our schools are not white, and yet we haven't seen anyone on Portland City Council representing those folks who have the lived experience. I know that every member of city council wants to believe that they're representing everybody. But when you don't see yourself, when you don't see your experience reflected at the highest decision-making table we have here in Portland, it doesn't feel like your voice matters. It doesn't feel like your perspective is represented in policymaking. So we really want to see a truly representative body that comes not just from close in Portland, but from all of Portland.
And we're running a little bit low on time here, but I was wondering really quickly if there are any opponents and what they're saying.
Well, we know in 2010, the Portland Business Alliance was one of the chief folks who didn't support the proposal. And they are likely to have the same position right now based on statements they've made in the paper. But we also know that most Portlanders support this kind of work. And that's why we're hoping folks can come out on Thursday, where the city council will have a hearing Thursday at 3 p.m. at City Hall. And it will be great to fill the room with folks who say this is what we need right now. This is what we need city council to pass. And so that's what we're encouraging folks to do. They can visit avoiceforallportland.org to learn more. And even if they can't come on Thursday, they can email city council through that website.
Cool. All right. Well, that's about all the time we have. Thank you so much for coming in, Jesse.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. That was Jesse Beeson of ColorPack. Find out more about open and accountable elections at www.act-or.commoncause.org.
Measure 97's potential impact on public institutions such as education has not been fully measured, according to a new report. The analysis says revenue generated from the measure actually could create a favorable business environment in the future. KABU reporter Al Khan with the Oregon News Service has more.
Two major economic reports on Measure 97 leave out the potential value of investment in education, healthcare, and senior citizen services to Oregon's economy, according to a new report. Dr. Richard Sims, chief economist for the National Education Association, analyzed the benefits of taxing businesses that make $25 million or more through in-state sales and then using that money to invest in public institutions, and concludes the extra revenue actually could strengthen Oregon's economy. Sims says businesses are especially interested in states with good educational systems.
They want to go where there's a high-quality workforce, and the best indicator of the high-quality workforce, they tell us, is the quality of the education system.
Sims says analysis by the Oregon Legislative Review Office and the Northwest Economic Research Center did not take into account the added value of improved public services from the corporate tax measure. Although the measure says the added revenue will be invested in education, healthcare, and senior services, opponents say the state is under no obligation to do so, and so the money could be misappropriated by lawmakers. According to Sims' calculations, with the state spending the estimated $3 billion in additional revenues it does now, the measure could add 62,000 jobs to Oregon over the next decade and increase personal income by $7.1 billion a year. Sims says the measure would actually create a favorable environment for companies because companies choose where they do business based on more than just taxes.
Businesses, like all of us, would rather have lower taxes than higher taxes, but we also locate where we get return on our tax dollars, and that seems to be where businesses locate. They tend to locate where they can get the services they need, the workers they need, the infrastructure they need, because that's what makes them more competitive and not simply low taxes.
Oregon ranks 35th in the country in per student spending, according to data from Educational Week's Quality Counts report. However, the state has the third worst high school graduation rate in the country. For KABU News, in partnership with the Oregon News Service, I'm Al Khan.
If you're tuned in to hear our last interview with Jesse Beeson of ColorPack, you can find more information about open and accountable voting by going to www.commoncause.org. Measure 97, the corporate tax measure on this year's ballot, received some strong support this week. Both Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have endorsed the measure. With the large voter support Sanders had in Oregon, his support of the measure could have a strong impact. Sanders has long been an advocate for large corporations to pay higher taxes. Senator Warren, who has a major tax battle in Congress coming next year, told the Huffington Post last week that citizens' initiatives like Measure 97 send a clear message that voters want to hold corporations accountable for paying their share.
Elections are just a week away, but Oregon voters have already started turning in their ballots. If you're one of those voters who's waiting, make sure to get ballots in an official Dropbox site by 8 p.m. on Election Day. If you're mailing it in, the Elections Office recommends that you get it in the mail by this Thursday so that it gets to the Elections Office by November 8th. If you're on the other side of the Columbia in Clark County, voters need to make sure to place ballots in a Dropbox location by 8 p.m. on Election Day, or mailed ballots in Clark County must be postmarked by Tuesday, November 8th.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for news in depth at 5:45, followed by Transpositive with Emma Lugo at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. News and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's and tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of rain, with the percentage climbing into the day tomorrow. East of the Cascades and Hood River will be partly cloudy this evening with a 20% chance of rain into the later half of the day tomorrow. Today in history, since colonial Spain colonized Mesoamerica, Dia de los Muertos has been celebrated on November 1st and 2nd. The holiday celebrated today by communities in Mexico and the Mexican diaspora all over the world is a mix of the Catholic traditions of All Saints' Day and All Souls' Day, along with customs long practiced by indigenous peoples in modern-day Mexico and Central America. To celebrate this spiritual holiday, on November 1st, families customarily built altars to celebrate children that have passed away. On the 2nd of November, dead adults are remembered through jubilant celebration. Dia de los Muertos emphasizes that the joys that deceased experienced in life, instead of the Western idea that death is tragic and morose. The quote of the day is from Spanish conquistador and colonizer of the so-called New World, Hernan Cortes, who said, quote, "I love to travel, but hate to arrive."
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Three Guatemalans waited till dusk to make their move. Evading security cameras in the remote expanse along the U.S. border, they slipped illicitly into our country. As the New York Times recently reported, this area is a haven for smugglers and cross-border criminal organizations. If Donald Trump were to witness such a scene, his hair would burst into flames and he'd rant so furiously his lungs would explode. But the Donald will never see this scene or even know about it because he's facing south, fulminating against Mexicans and assuring his faithful followers that he'll stop illegal entry into the U.S. by building a, quote, beautiful, impenetrable wall across our 2,000-mile border with Mexico. Meanwhile, the scene described by the New York Times took place way up north, where rural Vermont connects to Canada. With so many of our nation's political and security officials obsessed with the southern border, more and more criminal action, including smuggling people, drugs, and weapons, has been coming across our 5,500-mile Canadian border, the longest in the world between two countries. Running from the Atlantic to the Pacific, through sparsely populated and heavily wooded terrain, there's often no clear demarcation of where Canada ends and the U.S. begins. Some farms, homes, and businesses actually sprawl across the border. Meanwhile, only about 2,000 agents patrol this vast stretch, and officials concede they don't even have a good guess of how many people and how much contraband is coming across or where. This is Jim Hightower saying, "So, Mr. Trump, shall we wall off Canada too? And how much of our public treasury, democratic idealism, and international goodwill shall we dump into the folly of militarizing both borders? By simply thinking we can wall the world out, we'll be walling ourselves in. And that is suicidal."
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Many fans of public education are focusing on Measure 97, which would establish a new corporate income tax intended to fund schools, among other things. But Measure 98 is the education measure fewer people are talking about. Here with us tonight from the Yes on 98 campaign is Communications Director Peter Zuckerman. Thanks for coming in tonight, Peter.
Thanks for having me in.
So can you just give us a little background? What is Measure 98?
So Measure 98 would do three things. It would ensure that every high school student gets access to vocational and career technical education. It would make sure that Oregon's high school graduates are prepared for college by providing them with college readiness classes. And it would make sure that more students have access to dropout prevention strategies, which means more mentors, more just counselors, more people who help get students through high school.
So can you give us a little background about why we don't seem to have vocational programs as much in this country anymore?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, schools have just faced cut after cut after cut, year after year after year. And vocational education has been something that has just disappeared. And it's something that is so crucial. I mean, right now, Oregon has the third worst graduation rate in the country. It actually sunk to getting worse. And I just find that so disturbing. And one of the best ways to address that is through vocational and career technical education.
Let's talk about the impact on the graduation rate if vocational education were to be brought back. How would those rates be impacted, do you think?
Well, based on research that we've seen, we would see a pretty quick bump up in some school districts more than others, but by about 6 points, which is a huge increase. Right now, our graduation rate has just been flat with about 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 students dropping out. And so we could see a big increase. And that would, I mean, that's tens of thousands of students who would have a high school degree. And I mean, I think that college might not be it for everyone, but high school should be.
So can we talk about the significance of vocational education within this measure? Why is vocational training so significant?
Well, for some students, they learn better hands-on. And then also for a lot of students, they struggle to understand why a lot of their classes matter, why their math class matters, why they need to learn how to read things and things like that. But vocational education gives them that hands-on learning that is often a class they really enjoy and keeps them in school. And also, it makes other classes relevant because you see if you're taking a car repair class that, oh, I need to know math. And so it just, it makes the rest of school seem so much more important. And then there's the other side of the coin, which is once you graduate high school, you need options. And one option is definitely going to college. But college isn't going to work for everybody, and there are a lot of employers that are struggling to fill good-paying jobs, but there's nobody who's skilled to fill them, and so Measure 98 also helps bridge that gap.
And for people who aren't too familiar with vocational education, what are kind of like examples of the type of jobs that seek people with vocational training?
Yeah, from computer coding to 3D printing to robotics, medical care, advanced manufacturing. I mean, all kinds of classes, a lot of them in growing high-tech fields. One of the neat things about Measure 98 is that schools could decide what kind of classes they wanted and could tailor classes to ones based on what there's demand for in that industry or in that area.
You talked about this a little bit before, but can you talk about the other aspects of Measure 98 that aren't just the training? What else does it provide?
Yeah, so in addition to vocational and career technical education, it also provides college prep and advanced placement classes. And these are really important because we have a really big high school dropout problem, but we also have a big college affordability crisis. And Measure 98 helps get people who start college, make them more likely to finish, because you're more likely to finish college if you've taken some college classes. And frankly, a lot of times, if you've taken advanced placement classes, you can finish more quickly and it doesn't cost as much. And the cost of college is kind of crazy right now, and it seems to be going up year after year. And if you can get some classes under your belt before, then you're more likely to finish. And then the third thing Measure 98 does is it allows schools to hire more nurses, more counselors, more mentors, and establish programs to make sure that the students who are in school are more likely to finish. And that can make a huge difference because our graduation rate is so low. Vocational and career technical education is one of the best ways to address that, but you can also address it through dropout prevention strategies.
So one of the reasons that Portland's former high school superintendent shut down many of the vocational programs here was the reasoning that all students should be encouraged to attend college, as if college and vocational training are mutually exclusive. So, you know, talked a little bit about that, about college, but, you know, there's also these stereotypes that go behind vocational training. Could you share some thoughts about that?
Absolutely. I mean, right now, a lot of students graduate high school and they don't have many options besides working at a coffee shop or going to college. And for a lot of students, college is really expensive. But for a lot of them, college and vocational and career technical education are also the same thing, because a lot of vocational and career tech classes are actually also college classes. And there are all kinds of different college degrees, and there's certificates, and there are licenses, and there are all kinds of programs. And it is much easier. You're more likely to get a good job if you have a high school degree and some sort of additional training. What's really hard are for the students who don't finish high school at all. And I mean, our graduation rate is just so poor, and that's something we need to address immediately. I see it as a urgent problem, a crisis we have to deal with right now.
Is Measure 98 just about graduation rates, or is it a combination of graduation rates and addressing employment?
It's also a major part is addressing employment issues, because people are graduating high school, but it's hard in high school to find a good job. And the reason vocational education can help is in a couple ways. One, it allows students to know where there are lots of jobs and what kind of training they would need. So, for example, if they take a computer coding class or an electrical work class in high school, they might say, oh, I really like this. I'm good at this. I want to go to school for this. And those are areas where employers are really struggling to find workers versus without it, a lot of students graduate high school and they just, they're on their own and they don't know what they're good at and where there are lots of good jobs.
You're starting to run out of time a little bit, so I have to know. What are some of the obstacles you see in getting this measure passed and how can people support you?
Well, I would say the biggest obstacle we have in getting this passed is that people need to understand the value of education. We have been disinvesting in our schools year after year. And if we continue to do that, I am afraid for what can happen to our state. I mean, education is the foundation, I think, of a successful state, a successful economy, a good culture. Education does so many good things. And the number one thing you can do to help us win is first vote. Make sure everybody in your household votes. Make sure your friends vote. Check, get people registered to vote. Go out there and vote. I mean, it's if more young people voted, we would have such a different political system. And so many people right now are frustrated with politics. Well, the number one thing you can do is vote and get other people to vote.
Sure, many high school seniors who would are wondering about vocational training themselves could be voting in the, for this very measure themselves. So, if people want to find out more about this measure, can you point us to a website, or how can they find out more stuff?
Yes, voteyesfor98.org is a great place to find out more about Measure 98.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, for coming in. We're all out of time. So that was Peter Zuckerman, Communications Director for Yes on the 98 campaign. November 8th is Election Day, so find out more about the measure online at www.voteyesfor98, that's the number 98.org.
The wife of FBI Director, Deputy Director Andrew McCabe has come under fire. Dr. Jill McCabe received a donation of over $750,000 from Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe during her recent campaign for the Virginia State Senate. This action now has been called into question by Donald Trump, as Governor McAuliffe, a close friend and ally of Hillary Clinton. The Trump campaign alleges that the Clintons knew this money was being paid. The story was first reported in the Wall Street Journal and made no mention that Secretary Clinton had knowledge of the donation, nor did it mention that they were connected in any way to the FBI's investigation into Clinton's emails. According to the FBI, Deputy Director McCabe played no role, attended no functions, and did not participate in any type of fundraising. After his wife's failed campaign, McCabe received a promotion to Deputy Director, and while in that role, oversaw the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. The Colonial Pipeline in Shelby County, Alabama, exploded on Monday, killing one person and injuring seven. A wildfire resulting from the explosion covered 31 acres in the drought-stricken area. Several homes were evacuated in the nearby city of Helena, Alabama, and firefighters are working to control the fire. The same pipeline which carries gasoline from Houston to New York recently leaked, leading to a region-wide gas shortage, and it is believed that the explosion will increase gasoline prices in the area for weeks. Meanwhile, on Wall Street, gasoline futures rose 13%.
If you're a user of social media, you might have noticed many people expressing support for the pipeline protests in North Dakota in recent days. Yesterday, over a million Facebook users checked into the location of the pipeline protests in an effort to show virtual support. While people at the pipeline protests have expressed gratitude for the show of online support, they have been quick to point out that what the camp needs most is supplies. One local business owner recently decided to take direct action in helping out the water protectors at Standing Rock. KBOO News spoke with Cesar Felix, owner of Planet Over Profit Apparel, who is driving out to Standing Rock this week in a rental car filled with supplies provided by himself and donations from other local businesses.
So this was initially my idea, just out of the blue. I was just, you know, kind of fed up about what's going on. And then I slowly started talking. My business partner, Michael at Portland Hempworks, decided to chip in, and that kind of got the ball rolling. He chipped in some awesome hemp products, and he connected me with Mickey over at Alberta Co-op, and she's been awesome. She's been donating food and clothing that her employees got together for me. Also, I've been hitting a bunch of other co-ops throughout town, one in Hillsdale. I am picking up tomorrow. They're giving me a lot of wood, which I'm loading the rental car up to the gills as much as I can. And and also Buy and Buy has chipped in clothing. So many people have just come in, and some of my friends and family have chipped in with donations. I started a Venmo account, and they've just been helping out.
So what inspired you to, you know, a lot of people have been following along and they've been supportive, but, you know, to actually drive out there, it's quite a dramatic action. What inspired you to take such direct action?
I really just felt a calling. It was just something in me. I grew up in southern Arizona, deep Basque Yaqui traditions and cultures. So I've always felt connected, and I am Native American. And so I just really felt a calling to really do my part. And I was getting tired of seeing the injustice that those people in the Sioux Nation are dealing with right now. So I felt that, you know, I'm watching my brothers and sisters, but I just felt that I had to do something.
Do you have any more room for supplies if people want to support your efforts? Is there any way that they can do that?
My car is pretty much spoken for at the moment, but what they can do is they can donate, and I can turn those donations into gift cards, which they have requested, or they can donate gift cards. But at the moment, I think directly if they could donate to me, I can turn those into gift cards and whatnot, or hand them money directly.
And how can people do that, donate directly to you?
I have set up a Venmo account. It's at Caesar, C-E-S-A-R, dash Felix, F-E-L-I-X, dash 2. And that is my Venmo account, or I have a PayPal account. It's under my business name, Planet Over Profit Apparel, at gmail.com.
Is there anything you would like our listeners to know about your efforts or what you hope other people can do?
Yeah, I really hope that it can inspire more people to do it. It's something, I mean, I didn't think I could make happen in just over a week and a half of just from the initial idea. I mean, I work at a nonprofit. I don't have, you know, a lot of money or no money at that point. So it just, that, you know, the average person can do something, and love really does travel a long way. I mean, I've gotten so much love from so many people, and it's really just, you know, it's going to carry me there, and, you know, just so I can bring with me. And so that's one way that, you know, a lot of people can feel, you know, they're doing their part also is through me. And that's really an awesome feeling, and I think more people should do it also.
I really appreciate you just taking a few minutes while you're trying to load up and get ready to go.
Yeah, no problem. I really appreciate you taking your time.
For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Khan, Tony Glamour-Tramp Letigre, Kanan Schlesinger, Sunny Blechinger, and Jenny Yokoyama. The producer is Jenny Yokoyama. Special thanks to the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Roland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, it's Political Perspectives. And at 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, a video with Dennis Cycling Master Plan with Michelle Kunick-North, Project Manager for the Portland Off-Road Cycling Master Plan for the City of Portland, and Tom Archer, Board Member and Master Trail Builder for the Gateway Green, Portland's first off-road cycling-focused park. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the big red donate button. Night, Kanan.
Night, Jenna.
Night, Wesley.
Good night.
Night, Wesley.
Good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is a speech and Q&A sessions from Green Party VP candidate Jamu Baraka. Mr. Baraka spoke at Grand Rapids Community College in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
With no further ado, here's our next vice president, Jamu Baraka.
To make history? I said, are you ready to make history? Yes, we are making history. We really are. It is really an honor and a pleasure to be with you here this evening here in Michigan. As Luann said, we have been on a whirlwind of activity these last day and a half. It's been a lot, but I'm telling you, it's been gratifying to get a chance to spend time here in this great state, this very important state, and get a chance to dialogue and interact with some fantastic activists here in this state, including the activists from the Green Party. These are some fantastic folks, and I want to thank you all for all the hard work that you've been doing, and Luann, you in particular. So thank you so much. You know, folks, I've been—I've had a chance to really move around this country in a very intense way over the last few months, and I've seen a lot. I just did a press event, and the question was asked: What have people been asking us as we move across this country?